UAB MedCast is an ongoing medical education podcast. The UAB Division of Continuing Education designates that each episode of this enduring material is worth a maximum of 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit. To collect credit, please visit uabmedicine.org/medcast and complete the episode's post-test.
Welcome to UAB MedCast, a continuing education podcast for medical professionals. Bringing knowledge to your world, here's Melanie Cole.
Welcome. Our topic today in this panel-style discussion is the management of complex pancreatitis. Here to tell us about that are my guests, Dr. Andrew Gunn, he's an interventional radiologist, Dr. Ali Ahmed, he's an interventional gastroenterologist, and Dr. Sushanth Reddy, he's a hepatobiliary and pancreatic surgeon in surgical oncology, and they're all at UAB Medicine. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. And Dr. Reddy, I would like to start with you. Explain a little bit about pancreatitis. What is acute pancreatitis and can it become chronic?
Thank you, Melanie. Acute pancreatitis, like all of the itises, is inflammation of the pancreas. The pancreas is a large organ located in the back of the upper portion of the abdomen. Unlike the other itises, like tonsillitis or appendicitis, pancreatitis doesn't always involve infection, and that can be quite confusing to both doctors and patients alike. Acute pancreatitis is when the organ has been damaged by inflammation, but this is reversible. Several episodes of acute pancreatitis can lead to irreversible damage to the pancreas, and this is called chronic pancreatitis.
That's an excellent explanation. Dr. Reddy, thank you. And Dr. Ahmed, speak a little bit about the etiology of acute pancreatitis, and is there a hereditary link?
There are. Well, thank you for the question. There are many causes of acute pancreatitis. The main risk in the United States are gallstones and alcohol dependence, but genetic factors can also play a role, and we'll talk a little bit more about the hereditary pancreatitis a little bit later. Drugs, many medications, a common side effect will include pancreatitis. And then sometimes it could be a bite of a scorpion, although rare, that can also cause pancreatitis. Most often that is found on textbooks and test questions. And then iatrogenic, which is when a physician does a procedure such as an ERCP or an endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatogram, which can unfortunately have a side effect of causing pancreatitis. Now, regardless of the cause of the injury to the pancreas, the mechanism of injury is the same for all cases. There's a disruption of pancreatic enzyme secretion, and that's going to impede the exocytosis of the zymogen granules. These are the parts of the pancreas in the Eisenhower cells that contain the digestive enzymes. And if they get activated, this results in autodigestion. And it sounds just as horrible as it is. You start digesting yourself. An Eisenhower injury from autodigestion stimulates an inflammatory response, and in some cases, this response can be very severe and result in multi-organ failure, a sepsis, severe infection, and in rare cases, death. To answer your second question about the hereditary link, there are several genes that have been associated with hereditary pancreatitis, and some of the common ones are mutations in the serine protease 1 gene, known as PRESS1, and that encodes for a cationic trypsinogen. And this is probably the most common cause of hereditary pancreatitis, almost up to 80% of cases. Another gene that is associated is known as the serine protease inhibitor, Casal type 1 or SPINK1. And then cystic fibrosis associated with pancreatitis. Cystic fibrosis has many effects on many areas of the body, and it can also cause thickening of the secretions from the pancreas and is associated with hereditary pancreatitis. And just to give you an idea, people or patients that have hereditary pancreatitis often have chronic pancreatitis in the first or second decade of life, while those with the more common alcoholic pancreatitis will be diagnosed in their 40s and 50s.
Dr. Reddy, what are some of the symptoms of acute pancreatitis? What's the clinical presentation?
I always ask my patients if they've had an episode of acute pancreatitis, and many of them look at me and they say, I don't know what that is. If I hear that, I usually tell them, you haven't had acute pancreatitis. Acute pancreatitis is a very memorable event in most people's lives. People generally tell me that they have abdominal pain. The pain they can have, it can be quite severe. Traditionally, we talk about that pain being either in the epigastrium or the center of the upper portion of the abdomen or in the right side of the abdomen. In some cases, it can radiate to the back. A lot of folks also get nausea and vomiting. The onset of acute pancreatitis is typically anywhere from hours to at most about a day or so. Most patients will tell you that they were unable to control the pain at home. They had to come into the emergency department and receive pain medication in order to be able to control the pain. As Dr. Ahmed pointed out, people who have acute pancreatitis can actually go into multi-system organ failure, and unfortunately, that can happen relatively quickly. IV fluid resuscitation is an absolute necessity in the early management of people with pancreatitis.
Dr. Reddy, sticking with you for a minute, how important is the early diagnosis as being crucial to improve the outcome prediction? How is it diagnosed?
I will start, Melanie, with your second question, which is how is it diagnosed? To have a clinical suspicion of pancreatitis is really, really important. Patients are diagnosed with acute pancreatitis if they carry either a classic symptom such as abdominal pain, nausea, or vomiting, combined with an elevation in biochemical markers, specifically serum amylase or lipase, and or a radiographic finding. In other words, a CT scan or MRI that shows evidence of pancreatic inflammation. Early diagnosis is critical in the management of pancreatitis. I tell our students and residents to think of the pancreas as a gigantic sponge in the back of the abdomen. And just like the sponge in your kitchen, that the pancreas can soak up so much liquid. The result of that is that patients can become acutely dehydrated very, very quickly. The first step in managing somebody with acute pancreatitis is to resuscitate them with IV fluids as quickly as possible. It's not unusual to have to give anywhere from 5 to 10 pounds worth of IV fluid within the first 12 hours after someone comes to the emergency room with acute pancreatitis, just to try to keep them hydrated enough to avoid multi-system organ failure. The most important factor when it comes to treating patients with pancreatitis is diagnosis and early fluid resuscitation.
Wow, that's great information, Dr. Reddy. So, Dr. Ahmed, what are some of the possible complications from acute pancreatitis, as Dr. Reddy has pointed out, and you mentioned earlier about multi-system organ failure and the need to really hydrate heavily? Speak about some of the other complications that might, you know, that might arise if this is not treated quickly.
Yes, yeah, so the acute pancreatitis can have many complications, and they include infection of the pancreatic necrosis, and that can lead to the infection and sepsis that we've talked about, that Dr. Reddy mentioned. People can get recurrent attacks of acute pancreatitis. So if you think one attack is bad, they can have more attacks more frequently. They can have chronic pancreatitis where there's actually damage to the pancreas and is not able to perform its function in assisting in management of protein digestion, carbohydrate metabolism, and in management and resulting in a lot of complications from that. Patients can get pseudocyst formation where fluid develops outside of the pancreas, and that can result in blockage of the digestive tract with resulting nausea, vomiting, and inability to eat. They may get bleeding and complications from bleeding and life-threatening bleeding, and the complication is also death. And I'd say the other thing is, in this new era with concern about pain medications, people may develop chronic pain and then dependence on pain medication.
Dr. Gunn, to you now, what are some of the current issues in medical or surgical management? Speak about nutritional or pain meds, antibiotics, surgery. How is the management of complex pancreatitis treated?
Well, I think what we've heard so far is the biggest problem with pancreatitis is the fact that there can be such a diversity of clinical presentation. Patients can present with abdominal pain in the acute phase. They can present much later in the chronic phase. patients can present without symptoms of infection. They can present with symptoms of infection. They can present without vascular complications, with vascular complications, without pseudocysts, with pseudocysts. And so as far as medical and surgical management, the diversity of options, depending on how that patient presents, can pose a problem for a physician who's trying to manage a patient with pancreatitis on their own. And that's really the important part of having a multidisciplinary approach to pancreatitis, because you can really bring in the expertise of a variety of physicians, especially surgical oncologists or surgeons who could potentially remove part of an infected pancreas or part of a dead pancreas. But especially, you know, the combination of having an endoscopist like Dr. Ahmed or, skilled interventional radiologist, because when there become infected collections in there, they need to be drained out, whether that's drained endoscopically, where the fluid goes back into the gastrointestinal tract, or whether that's a percutaneous image-guided drain placed by interventional radiology, where we drain that fluid outside. Those discussions, you know, are really best had in a multidisciplinary approach. And so some of the current research in this area is really looking at what are the best ways to manage this drainage. Is it dual drainage, both endoscopic and interventional radiology? You know, the size of the drains that we put in, the size of the stents that we put in, what's the appropriate timing of that? And all of those things are active areas of research, which is a really exciting time for us here at UAB with our Pancreatic Biliary Disease Institute. So
I would like to add, for years, surgery was thought to be the primary mainstay for treatment of pancreatitis. And what we have learned the last 15 to 20 years is that surgery probably should be reserved for those patients whom the other interventions that Dr. Gunn mentioned were not effective. And we've moved more toward a minimally invasive approach to treating patients with pancreatitis. The situation where we have to actually remove large portions of dead pancreas is a very rare event nowadays, and that's a good thing for most of these patients.
Dr. Ahmed, let's talk about diet now, because I think that this is a big issue with someone who may have recurring flare-ups of pancreatitis. What kind of diet is recommended to avoid these flare-ups, and why are some foods triggers at some point and sometimes they're not?
Well, I think this is an excellent question, and it brings straight from my patients to your question. A patient will tell me, "Hey, I ate this last week and I was fine, and I ate it 3 months ago and I was sick," or vice versa. And it has almost no rhyme or reason. And this speaks to Dr. Gunn's point. We don't fully understand all the intricacies in the cause of pancreatitis. And that's why there are a lot of variables that are unanswered. So we have to sort of look at it in a focused approach and use some of the evidence that's in the medical literature. So a couple of things, looking at acute pancreatitis and nutrition, we do know that early feeding is better than late feeding, especially with the risk of infection that Dr. Reddy talked about. And we've also found that early feeding through the digestive tract is probably better than feeding through the vein or TPN or transparenteral nutrition. So anytime we can give enteral or feeding through either a tube going through the mouth, gastro-oral feeding, or through the nose, a nasogastric feeding, that's going to be preferred. And studies have also shown that whether that tube gets past the pancreas for jejunal feeding versus in the stomach, it's probably okay. And in some cases, if there's a blockage, you obviously want to get behind the blockage. But that addresses sort of nutrition in the early stage. In terms of a diet for patients, people have studied low-fat diet, high-fat diet, controlling carbohydrates, protein-rich diets, and unfortunately, there's no real recommendation. For a long time, we thought a low-fat diet would be appropriate for our patients, but recent data seems to show no evidence, and the gastroenterologic pancreas work study group has actually recommended a healthy diet. So we'll follow a balanced diet and hope that that will help. And then I think outside of food, we also want to modify reversible risk factors. Tobacco, smoking use, as we know, increases complications, risk, and susceptibility for pancreatitis through mechanisms that aren't fully understood, and then stopping alcohol. So if those things we can control and have people on a healthy diet, that should help them long-term and without giving them specific food recommendations.
Dr. Ahmed, I'm sticking with you for a minute because I'd like to ask you about vitamins or supplements and the risk for chronic malabsorption. As you were mentioning about various tube feeding, you know, what is the issue as far as absorbing the nutrients that they're going to need? And what do you recommend as far as vitamins and supplements and even enzymes?
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I think as people progress to chronic pancreatitis, enzyme supplementation plays an important role, and that becomes part of their regimen and often helps with pain management and symptom control. Patients that have problems with absorption are going to have problems with absorbing vitamins, and they're going to have vitamin deficiencies. And it'll be important for the physician to be looking out for that, and sometimes they'll have to check for vitamin deficiencies and do supplementation. People have looked at probiotics, which is a hot topic, but studies have not shown a benefit of probiotics in patients who have either acute or chronic pancreatitis. So I think we come back to looking at managing pain, giving them enzyme supplementation when they have to, especially those patients that have enzyme insufficiency, and then work on giving patients vitamin supplementation when they need it.
Dr. Gunn, what types of care are involved? Does this require the management of several aspects of care? You mentioned a little bit before the multidisciplinary approach. Speak about that a little bit in more detail.
Yeah, I really do think it requires a multidisciplinary approach because, as you can see, there are, you know, there's medical management for pancreatitis, there's minimally invasive endoscopic management for pancreatitis, there's minimally invasive percutaneous management for pancreatitis, and then, you know, at the far end of the spectrum, there's, you know, surgical management for pancreatitis. And so all of these different specialties have, you know, have a role to play. And just kind of depending on where the patient presents in that spectrum and what their symptoms are, you know, it's worth a healthy discussion from a group of specialists to be able to decide what's best for the patient. Here at UAB, we've recently started a pancreaticobiliary disease center, which involves surgeons, radiation oncologists, medical oncologists, gastroenterologists, interventional radiologists, and radiologists. And we've actually really seen, even in the first few months that we've been doing this, great success in treating patients with very difficult, you know, pancreatic necrosis and chronic pancreatitis, being able to transition them away from drains and kind of back into a normal lifestyle. So I would say that a multidisciplinary approach is crucial.
Gentlemen, I'm going to give you all each a last word. So, Dr. Reddy, I'd like to start with you. Can acute pancreatitis be prevented? And where do you see this whole multidisciplinary approach and treatment modalities? And, you know, where do you see this going in the next 5 years?
That's a good question. Can acute pancreatitis be truly prevented? And as Dr. Ahmed pointed out, there are several modifiable things that we can do to try to minimize the risk of acute pancreatitis. The first and most important thing is stopping risks such as smoking or even alcohol abuse. I tell my patients that those that quit drinking will likely decrease their risk of pancreatitis, but it won't turn to zero. The second most common cause of acute pancreatitis in the United States is gallstone-related disease. And for patients who have gallstones, their gallbladder should be removed when it is safe after the acute pancreatitis flare has ceased. That probably gives you your best chance of avoiding another flare of pancreatitis for gallstone-related disease. In terms of things that I'm looking forward to in the next 10 years or 5 years, it really comes down to things that Dr. Gunn has been pointing out this entire conversation. The idea that we can have multiple people working together to each bring their own expertise into a complex disease allows us to stop working in boxes and treat the patient from a true multidisciplinary approach. If I were a patient with a complex disease, I would love to know that I've got four or five doctors working together to try to treat me than having each person come in and give their single opinion and trying to do things in a sequential manner instead of in a much more coordinated manner. That's the thing that I'm looking forward to most, is seeing the things that people are going to come up with from interventional radiology, from advanced endoscopy, showing me the different ways we can treat things without having to resort to much more invasive approaches that we've been doing in the last 5, 10, or 15 years.
Dr. Gunn, your take on all of this, because it really is a fascinating interview when I have all three of you that work on different aspects of pancreatitis. So from your vantage point, what would you like to see happen in the next 5 years, and what would you like other providers to take away from this segment?
Well, first, I think what I'd like other providers to take away from this segment is that if you have a patient with pancreatitis and you feel like that the support system around you isn't sufficient to have a true multidisciplinary approach to that pancreatitis patient, to feel free to send them over to us, and so at least we can evaluate it in our multidisciplinary conference, and we can, you know, it's the patient isn't necessarily going to stay at UAB, but that patient's going to be evaluated, and we can send recommendations back to help physicians that are out in the community along. And so that's always our goal, is to help all the patients in this region with this disease process to a more normal and healthy lifestyle. As far as things that I see happening in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years, I really think looking at some of the things that Dr. Achman was talking about, as far as, you know, molecular markers or genetic markers or some of these modifiable risk factors, if we can improve on some of those things to prevent pancreatitis from happening, I think would be some of the things that would be most advantageous looking forward into the next 5 years or so.
And Dr. Ahmed, to you now, promising new therapies. And as you are an interventional gastroenterologist, you know, where nutrition and all of these therapies are involved, what do you see happening in the next 5 to 10 years? And as a summary and a wrap up, tell other physicians what you'd like them to know about pancreatitis and when it's important that they refer.
Well, I think pancreatitis has been around for centuries. And in the last 100 years, I think we've had trouble advancing our knowledge of the disease process, partly because what happens in the animal model cannot be replicated in the human model. And part of it is just learning more about it. And like Dr. Gunn and Dr. Reddy have mentioned, I'm very excited about this interdisciplinary approach where we have different guys or different disciplines that work normally separately are now working together to solve complex patient care. Pancreatitis often involves lengthy hospital stay, huge cost to the health system, and a lot of time. And by working together, we may become more efficient on how we approach these patients and hopefully result in better outcomes. Looking forward, I think there are going to be advances in how we look at the pancreas. I mean, I think from both the percutaneous approach and the endoscopic approach, there are new devices and tools that will be a camera known as pancreatoscopy, where we'll be inside of the pancreas duct and have better tools to manage complex lesions within the pancreas that may, down the road, lead to chronic pancreatitis. So perhaps we'll be able to better identify which patients will develop chronic pancreatitis. And maybe we'll be able to have molecular or genetic therapies for people with genetic deficiencies to prevent them from progressing from acute to chronic pancreatitis and maybe even reverse their disease process. For physicians out there, I think it's very important to understand that these patients may get sick very quickly. And as Dr. Reddy pointed out earlier in this talk, he had mentioned how early fluid and volume resuscitation is going to be very important to get patients better. And if they're not getting better in a day or two, I think it's very important to call quickly and get help from an institution that may have more resources, because even though surgery is not often used and going forward, people may not be as equipped to handle the surgical procedures, knowing who can will be important. And at the end of the road, surgery still remains an option for a small segment of patients.
Thank you so much, gentlemen, for coming on with us today in this panel discussion and sharing your expertise on pancreatitis and letting other providers know the important red flags and the treatment options available and even the important information on prevention and promising new therapies. Thank you again for joining us. A community physician can refer a patient to UAB Medicine by calling the MIST line at 1-800-UAB-MIST. That's 1-800-822-6478. You're listening to UAB Medcast. For more information on resources available at UAB Medicine, you can go to uabmedicine.org/physician. That's uabmedicine.org/physician. This is Melanie Cole. Thanks so much for listening.